Due to the density of urban communities in Gaza, it is simply not possible to use this artillery shell in a way that is compliant with international humanitarian law.
Hello and welcome to Security Dilemma, a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. I'm Patrick Carver-Fox, joined today by AJ Manuzzi as we speak with John Ramming Chappelle. John is an advocacy and legal fellow at the Center for Civilians in Conflicts U.S. program, but also an alumnus of the JQAS Marcellus Policy Fellowship. He works on law and policy issues related to civilian harm, arms sales, and security assistance. He's joining us today to talk about the specifics of the circumstances of civilian harm and the policy and legal frameworks meant to mitigate them, especially focusing on the Israeli offensive in Gaza. Join us in our conversation with John Ramming Chappelle. John Ramming Chappelle, welcome to Security Dilemma. I want to start by talking a bit about this $95 billion deal that just passed the Senate, with close to $22 billion going to Israeli military operations, but less than $10 billion going to humanitarian assistance for civilians worldwide. What are the precedents here?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Patrick. So I think what we're seeing here is a really discouraging action in the Senate to provide extensive security assistance to the Israeli military, without any real meaningful conditions on how weapons that are purchased using that assistance are used. Unfortunately, this is in line with what we have seen from the Biden administration thus far. Senior Biden administration spokespeople have said that there are no red lines, that there are no conditions when it comes to how the Israeli military uses U.S. origin weapons. What's even more discouraging here is that there was a real possibility of using this big vote in the Senate as a catalyst for accountability. There were some encouraging amendments that were proposed by folks like Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, Senator Van Hollen, and Senator Welch, all of which drew attention to offered solutions to the really devastating civilian harm and humanitarian crisis that we've seen caused by U.S.-provided weapons in large part. And it's also very discouraging that in this package, we see a restriction on funding to UNRWA, which is one of the most important providers of humanitarian assistance in Gaza today. And even though we do see money allocated in this funding package for humanitarian assistance, the delivery of humanitarian assistance to people suffering in Gaza is very difficult to imagine without having UNRWA able to play the role of facilitator and deliverer of aid that it has for so long. So this is a very disappointing action that's been taken. It's very disappointing that there were no amendments that received votes in the Senate. So now it's up to the Congress to ensure that there is meaningful oversight of U.S. weapons transfers to Israel and that there is accountability for the killing of more than 28,000 people in Gaza, many of whom are civilians, many of whom are women and children. And it's important that Congress fulfills their oversight role to advance the protection of civilians, because it appears that the Biden administration is unwilling to do so.
How have past administrations handled Israeli wars against, you know, Hezbollah or Hamas or any other group? How is the Biden administration handling it compared to past wars?
I'll say that the current Israel-U.S. relationship and this real pervasive impunity hasn't always been what we've seen in the U.S.-Israel relationship. So I'll give an example. Ronald Reagan imposed conditions on the U.S. provision of weapons to Israel. And when the Israeli military used U.S.-supplied cluster munitions in ways that resulted in really widespread and devastating civilian harm, there was, in fact, a cutoff of a certain aid to Israel. There are certainly ways to exercise oversight to ensure accountability, but what we're seeing today is no meaningful restrictions at all. Even as the world looks on to the devastation that we're seeing today in Gaza, this humanitarian catastrophe, there are not restrictions. What we're witnessing is kind of unprecedented. This war has been described as one of the most destructive in recent memory. We see the widespread use of explosive weapons in densely populated areas. And when explosive weapons are used in densely populated areas, estimates show that about 90% of victims are civilians. To sum it up, with the Biden administration's policy, we see an extent of devastation that we've rarely witnessed, an extent of U.S. implication in that devastation that is also quite rare. And to round it all off, we see impunity. And that has not been the case for U.S. policy always. But unfortunately, it seems that the Biden administration is doubling down on this approach.
On the issue of conditions and restrictions, a few weeks back, the Senate killed a Bernie Sanders resolution to invoke Section 502B of the Foreign Assistance Act for Israel, which would have triggered a State Department review of Israel's human rights practices and potentially placed a pause on arms transfers to the country. You'd previously advocated in a piece for Just Security a similar approach to the U.S.-Saudi Arabia relationship. Could you explain for our listeners just how that mechanism works and why you think it can be a tool that's productive in these circumstances?
Thank you, AJ. So Section 502B of the Foreign Assistance Act dates all the way back to the 1970s. It was kind of one of the landmark accomplishments of the human rights movement in Congress at that time. And it resulted from a series of hearings led by Congressman Don Frazier of Minnesota. And what this statute does is it creates a way for Congress to request further information on the human rights record of a particular country. The same law also creates the annual human rights reports of the State Department, and it also requires that no U.S. security assistance go to any country where the government engages in a consistent pattern of gross violations of human rights. So what is this process that we see set up in Section 502B? Well, it starts with the ability for any member of the Senate to introduce a privileged resolution that requests additional information on the human rights record of any country. Then, if it passes, the State Department has a limited amount of time to produce that report. And after the State Department produces the report, then Congress is able to introduce another resolution, joint resolution of disapproval, that can either modify, continue, or end security assistance to a specific country. And so what we see here with Senator Sanders' use of Section 502B is actually the first time in the history of the statute that there has been a vote on one of these resolutions. There was a set of reports provided in 1976, but those were provided in response to a request of a committee chair, and so there wasn't a vote. And so this is a really historic invocation of this strong human rights oversight mechanism by Senator Sanders. And we already see that other members of the Senate are seeing what Senator Sanders has done and following suit, for example, with another joint resolution or another Section 502B resolution of request focused on Azerbaijan. And you also mentioned the Senator Murphy resolution focused on Saudi Arabia. So we see a real resurgence of this tool, and it's a tool that can complement some of the other mechanisms that are in the human rights oversight toolbox that Congress has at its disposal.
Last week, the White House issued a new arms transfer memorandum requiring written assurances from foreign governments that they won't use U.S. arms to violate human rights. How do you think this memo will impact U.S. arms transfers to Israel?
Sure, good question. So I'll start off by giving credit where it's due here, because while the memorandum did come out of the White House, it's based in large part on an amendment to the supplemental that we talked about earlier. And that amendment came from Senator Christopher Van Hollen, and it had nearly 20 co-sponsors from Senate Democrats. So what we see here is, you know, an indication that congressional pressure is being felt at the White House. And that there's no way around dealing with any possible U.S. complicity in civilian harm and possible violations of international law. Now, what does this memorandum actually do? Well, the first thing I'll say is that it builds on and references already binding U.S. law and also international law. So as you mentioned, there's this requirement for assurances, and the assurances say that countries receiving U.S. weapons, specifically taxpayer-funded U.S. weapons, will comply with international human rights law and international humanitarian law in their use of those weapons, and also that they'll comply with Section 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act. And much like Section 502B that we chatted about a bit earlier, Section 620I is kind of a long-forgotten restriction on arms sales and security assistance, that it hinges on the restriction of U.S. humanitarian aid. What this provision of the Foreign Assistance Act says is that the U.S. cannot provide security assistance to any country where the government restricts the delivery of U.S. humanitarian aid. This, I think, is one of the more important things that we see in this memorandum, is the spotlight that it puts on this binding provision of U.S. law that, as far as I'm aware, has never really been implemented and honestly hasn't really even come onto the radar much since it was enacted more than two decades ago. So the assurances are kind of at the center of this national security memorandum. And the other notable aspect of the memorandum is reporting to Congress. And so we've seen with memoranda like this that the administration is often hesitant to fully implement them as they should be implemented. And that's one thing that we've seen with the conventional arms transfer policy, which is equally authoritative to this new memorandum. Having congressional reporting is important because it flags for Congress whether there have been violations and whether the executive branch is being honest about any violations that might have occurred. And that kind of sets up the opportunity for Congress to legislate and conduct oversight, which is especially important for Section 620I. This, as I said, provision of law that's been long ignored, rarely invoked, and a provision of law that we see arguably being violated today. Just recently, the Israeli government blocked a shipment of U.S.-funded flour that was headed for Gaza, a shipment that the Biden administration had actually pressured to be delivered. If that's not a violation of Section 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act, it's hard to imagine what is. And so Senator Van Hollen, the pressure that his amendment created translated into this new national security memorandum, and we see that it is putting back on the map this long forgotten provision of law. But when it comes to implementation, it's all going to come down, I think, to how much attention Congress pays and how willing they are to hold the administration and, by extension, the Israeli government accountable.
Accordingly, is it your assessment that the U.S. government is not following its own rules on arms transfers, in particular in this case?
I think we see a lot of instances that call into question whether the United States government is faithfully implementing its own laws and policies. I'll just give one example, which is the conventional arms transfer policy that I mentioned just a minute ago. This policy was celebrated when it came out because it imposes a stricter standard for atrocity prevention than any of its predecessors. The first of these policies was released under President Carter. And then there were others under later presidents, but none of them had ever had as strong of a standard for atrocity prevention as President Biden's, which says that an arms transfer shall not be approved to a country if it is deemed more likely than not that the weapon in question will be used to facilitate, commit, or aggravate the risk of certain atrocity crimes that are listed. And those include war crimes, genocide, and a number of other violations of international law. Now, it's hard to imagine, looking at the situation that we see in Gaza today, how it is not more likely than not that certain weapons the United States has transferred will be used in violation of international law. To list a couple of specific examples, the United States has transferred 155-millimeter artillery shells, tens of thousands of them. And there was a report from Oxfam that said that due to the density of urban communities in Gaza, it is simply not possible to use this specific type of artillery shell in a way that is compliant with international humanitarian law. I think that what we see is likely violations of U.S. law and policy, and there are a number of examples to demonstrate that, and that's just one of them.
What are some principles that you would like to see the United States apply when it designates and regulates security assistance to foreign security partners?
Sure. Well, I think that there is always a need to consider the negative consequences that could arise from security assistance and arms transfers. So I focus a lot on civilian harm that occurs due to U.S. security assistance, but there's all kinds of other negative consequences that can come. And so, for example, the contribution to corruption, fueling organized crime or armed violence, sending a message of political support to a government that might be oppressing its people or cracking down on peaceful protest, things like that. And so I think that generally I would like to see a stronger role for these concerns when the U.S. government makes decisions about whether to support another government with lethal weaponry. And we see every administration has had a slightly different calculus for how they do this. And we see those calculuses coming through the conventional arms transfer policies. But I think that there is generally not enough appreciation for the ways that U.S. weapons can directly and indirectly both contribute to harm to civilians and human rights abuses, and also implicate the United States in those abuses.
Talking about implicating the United States in abuses, one of the news stories that came up early in the Israeli offensive into Gaza that I feel has gotten kind of lost in the noise is the provision of tens of thousands of small arms to Israeli settlers in the West Bank. What should people know about the circumstances of the West Bank and violence against Arabs living in the West Bank or even within Israel's borders?
Yeah, I think we see that there's a really high risk of violence escalating in the West Bank and in Israel. And amid the urgency and immediacy of the crisis in Gaza, I think that it's been difficult for many people to split their attention and fully assess what is a really devastating situation in the West Bank today. And we've seen a whole number of violations taking place. And unfortunately, this is happening in a situation where the United States, again, is not implementing its own law and policy in good faith. And one great example here is the Leahy Law. The Leahy Law prohibits the provision of assistance to any unit of foreign security forces where the U.S. government has credible information that unit has committed a gross violation of human rights. Gross violations of human rights in this case include things like extrajudicial killings and arbitrary detention, both of which have been real concerns in much of the West Bank, not just since October 7th, but for many years. And so I am worried that the United States is sending a real message of impunity because it has never found a single unit of Israeli security forces to be barred from receiving U.S. security assistance under the Leahy Law. We saw really in-depth reporting from The Guardian about exactly how that happens. But the West Bank includes, or we've seen a lot of situations in the West Bank that for another country, any other country, we would expect to trigger a bar under the Leahy Law. And unfortunately, that has not been the case. The Leahy Law is meant to promote accountability through its remediation process, which allows for units to receive assistance again if the perpetrators of a gross violation of human rights are brought to justice. But for Israel, the United States government has never even gotten that far because it has never found that a gross violation of human rights has occurred.
I want to talk about a pretty specific instance that's received more attention. There's mounting evidence that white phosphorus was used in the initial Israeli bombing campaigns in Gaza. The White House has stated that they are concerned, but described white phosphorus as a legitimate military utility. What are important precedents about the use of white phosphorus, and how should the White House have responded?
So when it comes to the use of white phosphorus, this is one of those weapons that is not per se prohibited under international law, but that does have to be used in certain ways to ensure that it is compliant with international humanitarian law. And so any military action needs to distinguish between civilians and military targets. It also needs to be proportionate. There needs to be proportionality between the expected military advantage gained and the incident harm and the harm to civilians that occurs. And there's a requirement in international humanitarian law that there is a military advantage, that there are not actions taken that don't advance military ends, and also that there is not any unnecessary suffering that occurs, the principle of humanity. So when it comes to use of white phosphorus, we've seen major human rights organizations find that the particular circumstances in which white phosphorus have been used raise serious concerns about compliance with international humanitarian law. There are ways to use white phosphorus that do not violate international humanitarian law. But in the specific instances that organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have investigated, some organizations have found that they are being used in populated areas where there is too high of a risk of civilians being harmed. And there have been civilians harmed, in fact, by the use of white phosphorus. And so this is certainly something to keep track of, especially for the U.S. government, because some of the shells containing white phosphorus that have been used have been found to come from the United States. And so we recently, or there was recently reporting that there's tracking within the U.S. government of civilian harm that occurred due to the use of white phosphorus originating from the United States.
We're recording this on February 16th. By the time of this episode is released, we might already be learning about what happens, but there seems to be an imminent assault on the city of Rafah on the southern border of Gaza, where something like 1.3 million Palestinians have gathered, most of whom are refugees from attacks further north. Why is this, why is Rafah specifically important?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we see that, as you said, over a million people from other parts of Gaza have gathered in Rafah because they believed it to be safe. Now the Israeli military is planning an assault on the city, a place that is a home to all of these people who have already fled and now are in often situations of temporary housing, situations where they don't have strong networks, and they're packed in very closely. I have mentioned before the devastating effects of explosive weapons being used in populated areas. The more dense a population is, the higher the risks of civilian harm from the use of explosive weapons in populated areas are. In Rafah, I think we see the possibility of harm that we haven't witnessed since the beginning of the Israeli attacks, of the Israeli campaign. And this should raise really serious concern for everyone in the U.S. government, because we've heard that the Biden administration has urged the Netanyahu government to take measures to protect civilians in Rafah, but it hasn't used its leverage. The United States has leverage in the form of the security assistance and arms sales that it provides to the Israeli government. And without implicating that leverage, anything that comes from the Biden administration are no more than empty words. So the time is now, urgently, to communicate to the Israeli government that not only is an assault on Rafah in the same way that we've seen in other parts of Gaza unacceptable, but that the Biden administration will actually restrict or cut off certain forms of security assistance and arms transfers if it proceeds.
You talked a little bit earlier about UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, following Israeli allegations that several members of that organization were in the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel in some capacity. Many of the Western democracies, including the United States, halted funding for the agency. And as you mentioned, the Senate passed foreign aid bill extends that pause to an outright ban. What sort of civilian consequences might a significant ban on that funding have for Gaza?
It is pretty devastating what we're seeing with the U.S. posture toward and the posture of other governments towards UNRWA right now. I think that one way to look at this is that based on the accusations against just a handful of people within an organization on tens of thousands, the U.S. government has suspended assistance to an organization that provides life-saving aid every day. In the meantime, it has been unwilling to even question provision to Israel of lethal assistance in the form of arms transfers. So what will the effect of this be? Well, we've seen that U.S.-provided weapons have played a significant role in the humanitarian catastrophe that we're seeing in Gaza. It is U.S. bombs, U.S. artillery shells, and other U.S.-provided weapons that have destroyed the medical infrastructure, that have destroyed the sanitation systems, that have flattened civilian homes. And all of this has created a recipe for disaster. It has increased, all of this has left Palestinians in Gaza facing an imminent famine, and also death from preventable disease. People in Gaza need humanitarian assistance urgently. And unfortunately, humanitarian assistance cannot be delivered without UNRWA. It's just too central to the delivery of humanitarian aid in Gaza. And humanitarian assistance also cannot be delivered, as both those working for humanitarian aid agencies and those receiving aid are living under bombardment. So what we need is a meaningful opportunity to deliver humanitarian aid, and we need a stronger and not weaker infrastructure to do so. And that will not be available if the suspension of assistance to UNRWA continues. The last thing I wanted to raise here is that UNRWA has, I think, in the eyes of many, done all the right things. Obviously, the October 7th attacks were horrible. They were, you know, led to extensive civilian death. They were brutal. And UNRWA did the right thing by firing the people who were accused of having participated, by launching an investigation at the highest levels of the United Nations, and by being in communication with governments about the accusations that were made. And again, it's highly discouraging that we're seeing a cutoff of life-saving humanitarian assistance due to accusations around just a handful of people within an organization of tens of thousands.
I want to turn now to the issue of arms sales. It's the conventional wisdom has essentially been that U.S. arms sales and deeper defense relationships grant it leverage over its partners that it can wield to pursue its interests. However, what we're currently seeing often in the Middle East with the Saudis and the Emiratis is security partners exploit their leverage and leverage the U.S. fear of China or rival powers against it to solicit deeper commitments and more arms sales from the U.S. government, basically saying, you know, if you don't give these to me, I will go to China. So how much do you think that conventional wisdom actually stands, passes the smell test today?
You just put it very well. One of the things that we hear most often when there is questioning of whether an arms sale should proceed is, well, if the United States doesn't sell weapons to X, Y, or Z country, then Russia or China are going to. And I think we should be really concerned about that because it creates a race to the bottom. It creates a situation in which the stated values of the United States and foreign policy can be compromised in any situation because the extent of great power competition is such that the U.S. can express concern about the possibility of a country turning further towards Russia or China anywhere in the world. And your description is a really good expression of reverse leverage. The idea that other countries can use that threat of going to a great power competitor in order to exert power over the United States. We see that rarely does the United States use its leverage when it counts. That is the case with Saudi Arabia, where we, for example, saw a U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia proceed for the same weapons that were used to massacre Ethiopian migrants at the Yemen-Saudi border. And so I think that this story that circulates very widely of if we don't sell, someone else will. It needs more scrutiny. It needs real questioning. And there's been great work from folks at the Stimson Center, for example, that question these assumptions and that ask, is this really true? What is the actual likelihood of another country, a partner or recipient of U.S. weapons, turning to China or Russia if an arms sale does not go through on human rights grounds? I think that these are exactly the conversations and the challenges to conventional wisdom that we need to be having, especially as the logic of great power competition increasingly becomes the lens through which all decisions are made in U.S. foreign policy.
The indirect outcomes of arms sales to foreign countries is something that I want to explore a little more for a second, partially because I've been pretty curious about arms transfers from the UAE and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to factions in something like the Sudanese civil war. It brings to mind, you know, convoluted pathways for arms transfers like Iran-Contra, but also might just not be in America's interest for either or both of the factions in that civil war to be receiving American arms. How have our more recent provision of arms complicated or circumvented norms about arms sales that we otherwise seek to maintain?
I think that first of all, it's just important to recognize the scale of U.S. arms transfers, right? According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute and their most recent data, the U.S. sells more weapons than the next four countries combined, if I remember correctly. And so that amounts to about 40% of the global market share for weapons. And so we see U.S. weapons implicated in conflicts around the world, whether they got there directly from the United States or indirectly. And Sudan is a really devastating case where ostensibly a U.S. partner, United Arab Emirates, is arming and providing support to a faction in this war that has caused immense harm to civilians and that has been accused of violating international humanitarian law and possibly committing war crimes. So this is another place where the United States has leverage that it could use. The United States could bring the United Arab Emirates and its government to the table and say, we see clearly that you are arming and providing support to the RSF and its leader Khamenei in Sudan. And that is not acceptable for a U.S. partner, and your ability to be eligible to receive U.S. Support is on the line. We haven't seen that happen. And that is despite some pressure from some members of Congress to bring this to light more. And so, you know, the arms trade is a very risky business. It has immense costs, immense human costs around the world. And unfortunately, the United States rarely uses the security assistance and arms sales that it provides to other countries as leverage appropriately in the ways that I think it should.
A big issue in U.S. grand strategy and civilian protection, where these two areas converge, is airstrikes. According to the watchdog group Air Wars, based out of the UK, U.S. strikes in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen have almost entirely terminated during the Biden administration. Somalia, however, is a different story. While the Trump administration presided over an unprecedented increase in strikes, more than 200, that still far exceeds the Biden administration's numbers, U.S. strikes in Somalia have increased with each year of President Biden's presidency. What do you think explains this continuity, and is it a sustainable approach?
You're right to give the Biden administration credit where it is due when it comes to the issue of airstrikes, and our colleagues at Air Wars have shown that there is a marked decline, luckily, in the U.S. reliance on airstrikes around the world. That doesn't mean that they don't continue in many places, and there are still significant concerns that remain when U.S. airstrikes harm civilians. And in fact, there was a really powerful piece of investigative reporting by Nick Turse in The Guardian, there was recently a really powerful piece of reporting by Nick Turse in The Intercept about a woman who was killed alongside her daughter, if I remember correctly, in a U.S. airstrike and has not received compensation for the U.S. government. This was in Somalia, and the United States has millions of dollars set aside for so-called ex gratia payments, like policy-based payments that are given to people who are harmed in U.S. military actions or whose family members were killed. And this pot of money is almost never used. And I believe it was 2020, zero payments were made. In 2021, only one payment was made. And this is in the context of U.S. military operations that kill and harm civilians around the world. So now turning specifically to Somalia, I think that what we see here is an increase or a sustainment, perhaps, of U.S. airstrikes in a context where Somali military is fighting a campaign against al-Shabaab. And so that is the context in which many U.S. airstrikes are occurring in Somalia, often in conjunction with Somali military operations. One really concerning thing, though, is that all of the statutes and authorities that existed under the Trump administration are still there. A future president could very easily and likely will reverse the Biden administration's decisions to reduce the reliance on airstrikes. And that should be a real cause for concern, and it should be a project in Congress to ensure that there is sufficient oversight over these airstrikes, and that there are limitations put in place to ensure that civilians are not harmed when it is avoidable. And the last thing that I'll say here is that there's a whole other category of concerning airstrikes, which are airstrikes carried out by the CIA. by an intelligence agency, not a war-making agency, that is not subject to the same oversight, accountability, and transparency as the Department of Defense, for example. And so it's good that we see legislation actually in Congress to transfer the authority to conduct lethal airstrikes from the CIA over to the Department of Defense, where it is in a framework of greater transparency and accountability.
From the lens of civilian harm and otherwise trying to pursue American interests in a way that it avoids negative consequences, how is an over-the-horizon approach to counterterrorism improved or otherwise failed to be implemented within the Biden administration?
Yeah, thanks for this question. I don't know if I have a perfect answer for you, but I would say that when it comes to, quote, over the horizon airstrikes and hostilities, we see continuing consequences for civilians. We see that even in the context of so-called over the horizon operations, there is still immense harm that results to communities, that there is still a lack of accountability when people are harmed. And as I mentioned earlier, we see that the tools that the United States does have to provide compensation for people who are harmed aren't adequately used. And so I think that it's important to keep that in mind, that just because strikes are happening, quote, over the horizon, doesn't mean that the situation is any better for the people who are living under U.S. bombs that are being dropped.
AJ was just mentioning the fact that we've seen fewer airstrikes in Yemen during the Biden administration, but that's also been less true over the last few months with the airstrikes against the Houthis. How have those been conducted within the lens of civilian harm?
That's a good question, Patrick. I think the evidence is still coming in. We're going to see reporting in the coming days and weeks from organizations that specialize in monitoring of civilian harm. One thing that I would say is that we see all of this happening in a context where there hasn't been accountability for war crimes, and that's based on the determination of major human rights organizations that the Saudi-led coalition carried out using U.S. weapons. And so there is certainly a high risk of that pattern repeating itself with U.S. strikes occurring. And, you know, thinking back to just a few years ago when a U.S.-made bomb was used to bomb to attack a school bus, we still have not seen meaningful accountability for that and other incidents that appear to violate international humanitarian law. So it's a very important situation to keep eyes on. My thoughts are always with the people who are dealing with the consequences of these decisions.
I believe back, you know, years ago when you did your Marcellus Policy Fellowship, you wrote about West Africa. How has U.S. arms sales to West African countries conducting counterterrorism operations like Chad and Nigeria, how have those been conducted over the last few years? What's the state of terrorism there, and how has the departure from ECOWAS of countries like Burkina Faso and Mali affected the security circumstances in that region?
So when it comes to West Africa, what we've seen is U.S. support increasing since the beginning of the war on terror. And it appears that that U.S. support has not led to the desired outcome of decreasing the number of armed extremist groups and also decreasing violence. We see that too often U.S. supported governments are contributing to the very challenges that the United States is trying to address, Because a lot of the problems in the Sahel really come back to governance. They come to governance problems that I think don't have easy military solutions. Then in Nigeria, we see that the Nigerian military has a really concerning record of civilian harm and human rights abuses. And despite that, the United States government has continued with arms sales and security assistance. It's done so often alongside limited human rights or international humanitarian law training, but there's no evidence that that is sufficient to actually mitigate the risk. And so I'm actually about to start a project, and so I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, about to start a project with colleagues in Nigeria that is examining how civilian harm factors into the U.S.-Nigeria security relationship, especially after a really devastating airstrike that the Nigerian military carried out in December that left dozens of civilians dead.
We really appreciate the work that you're doing on these important issues. But I also want to note that you were involved with JQAS, both on the chapter level and as a Marcellus Policy Fellow. How has JQAS played a role in your education and career advancement? And for anyone else who might be wanting to sort of follow in your footsteps and work on similar things, what kind of advice would you have to offer?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I mean, so I've been involved in JQAS since I was an undergraduate at the University of Mississippi, and then was a Marcellus Policy Fellow, and have also participated in JQAS reading groups and spoke at the last conference alongside one of my colleagues. And so it's a really phenomenal network. It is a good group of people from different fields and different perspectives who I've really enjoyed sharing experiences with. And I'd say that one of the strongest things that JQAS has done with for my career was the Marcellus Policy Fellowship, which really kickstarted my public writing. So my first publication in this field was in Responsible Statecraft, writing on U.S. counterterrorism policy and security assistance in the Sahel. And since then, I've published in Lawfare, Just Security, The Hill, Defense News, a handful of more academic journals. And that has been really, really invaluable for me as I'm building my profile as an analyst and advocate.
Well, John Reming Chappelle, thank you so much for coming on Security Dilemma.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to speak with you both.
Security Dilemma is a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. To learn more about our programs, visit our website at jqas.org. Remember to rate and review on your podcast app and join us every Tuesday for new episodes of Security Dilemma.